an incidence far higher than what's reported to federal officials and five times higher than breast or prostate cancer. In another study, researchers say the number of procedures used to treat skin cancer among Medicare recipients increased nearly 80% over just 14 years. Earlier research, however, does raise questions about the number of skin cancer cases diagnosed and suggests doctors are performing unneeded biopsies and diagnosing skin cancer inappropriately. Patty Namond, NPR News.
Embattled golfer Tiger Woods says he'll return to the professional circuit next month at the Masters tournament. Woods left the Pro Tour last November after news surfaced about many affairs the married golfer had had. Woods says after a necessary break, he's ready to start his season again. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. On the Tuesday edition of Live and Local, I'll talk with David Commande, conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, who give their next concert in Peoria on Saturday. And just in time for St. Patrick's Day, the Irish group Danu will perform in Urbana Tuesday night. I'll talk with one of their founders and play some of their tunes. Live and Local airs weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dill, Jason Croft, is on the board this morning. We're happy to have here in the studio with us today a writer. His name is Manuel Martinez. He's a writer. He's a professor of American and Chicano literature at Ohio State University in Columbus. He's the author of three novels, Crossing, Drift, and his most recent is Day of the Dead. And he's here visiting the campus to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival that's sponsored in part by the Creative Writing Program here at University of Illinois. And as part of all of this, he'll be doing a reading this afternoon at 4:30. And the Author's Corner, that's at the Illini Union Bookstore. In fact, I think that's where all of the events in connection with this festival are taking place. There are different people here from this campus, from outside, talking about a number of things like talking about e-books and the publishing world and about writing and a lot of different things. So we're pleased to have him here in the studio with us to talk a little bit about writing generally and writing his writing in particular. And you can head out to the bookstores and look for his books. And if you're interested, of course, anybody who would like to stop by the reading this afternoon, 4:30, it's open to the public, and anybody can do that. Also, here on the program, you can call in. We have questions possible, invited. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email your comments to will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, people want to be involved in the conversation, they are certainly welcome to do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's really a wonderful opportunity to be here talking with you.
Like, I suppose, ultimately, for any writer, the stories he or she tells do come out of their life. And it certainly seems that your growing up in San Antonio and your experiences as a kid and experiences of your family form an important basis for the stories that you tell. Are there particular kind of stories that really appeal to you?
Well, I think when I started out deciding I was going to write, and I basically began my writing career about the age of 20, I decided, I think like most writers, that there were some outstanding issues, things that had happened to me growing up. And so a lot of my early fiction was autobiographical, and I think I did want to, in fact, respond to the kinds of limitations and the kinds of opportunities that growing up on the west side of San Antonio, which is essentially the barrio of San Antonio, heavily Mexican-American, a long-standing area in which people have lived, Mexican-Americans have lived in continuously for over 150 years. And I wanted to tell the story of that place because it is a unique place to have grown up and to have tried to navigate as a youngster. And so my early writing career was very much dedicated to exploring that place.
Well, tell us more about it.
Well, San Antonio is approximately a city of about 1.5 million people. About half the population is Mexican-American and is heavily centered on the west side. And it is a neighborhood where my grandparents lived and where I was raised. It's primarily Spanish-speaking. In fact, you can grow up your entire life there and not have to speak English. So it's still very much a place where shopkeepers and the neighborhoods and even the schools are very much constituted along a kind of ethnic, racial component that people who are of Mexican descent can feel very comfortable living in. And, you know, as a place that is deeply impoverished, at least on the economic level, people have to make do and they have to survive. And I learned from a very early age, being raised primarily by my grandmother, who had herself been a migrant farm worker, that these challenges were things that you had to meet head on. Hmm. And so I think from the ages of 4 or 5 years old, I was already learning that there were a lot of obstacles out there. And my grandmother never let me get away with making or letting obstacles get in the way of succeeding. And so even though she herself only had a 4th, 5th grade education, she stressed education. And so for me, the West Side was a place where I learned my first language, Spanish. I didn't speak English, in fact, until I was about 5 years old and entered the school system. But it's also a place, even as deeply impoverished as it is, has a wonderful core of creativity about it. In Spanish, the slang word for it is rascuachismo, which basically means a kind of improvisational mode that people go into where they have to put things together on a sort of can-do basis, make-do basis. And so I think that that leads to a kind of mentality where people have to be creative in order to survive. And I credit a lot of my own desires to write and to think artistically to the fact that people around me were constantly being creative on an everyday material level.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you think Spanish, having had Spanish as a first language and having still that be important to you, informs the way that you write?
Absolutely. First of all, I try and use Spanish as much as possible in my writing. But more than that, I think that I wanted to work with the language and the culture and to explore it and depict it at a kind of level that would escape the sort of stereotypes of it. So I wanted to explore beyond the sort of image of the migrant worker or of the undocumented immigrant or of the very poor. And I wanted to really give voice to some of these elements that are not explored in mainstream media and even in literature to a large extent.
Yeah. Well, it's very clearly you're among the themes that you're interested in exploring, race and class are there and very important. And as I was looking at your writing, I found myself wondering, well, what is the difference, or how is it different doing that in fiction? Mm-hmm. How would that be different doing than if you were doing some kind of journalism, for example?
Well, I think first of all, I think that the kind of journalistic forays into Mexican-American life are usually rooted in an exploration, even a sort of tourism of impoverishment and of living in the shadows. And so for me, fiction was a way to explore the realities that go much deeper than what journalism tends to do. I mean, there's a lot of great journalism out there, but generally journalists who or academics who tend to look at these areas do so from a much more limited, narrow lenses. And I wanted to talk about people like my grandmother, my grandmothers, and friends and people that I grew up with that can't be encapsulated in the kinds of ways that journalism or academia seems to approach them. I want to talk about real stories and the kind of depth that you find. And you can do that in fiction. So all of my fiction, even though I don't live in San Antonio anymore, I haven't lived in South Texas since I was about 21, so about 20 years that I've spent outside the area, everything that I still write is rooted back in that specific place.
Yeah. Our guest, Manuel Luis Martinez, he's a professor of American and Chicano literature at Ohio State University in Columbus. He's a writer. He's produced three novels, Crossing, Drift, and Day of the Dead. He's here on campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. He'll be giving a reading this afternoon, 4:30, on the campus at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. Anyone welcome to attend. Also, questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Your first novel, Crossing, was apparently inspired by a real event, and in right at the front of the book, you reproduce a short article from the newspaper in El Paso.
Right.
Or at least the event happened in El Paso. Maybe it was for actually the San Antonio paper, about a group of men, undocumented men, who were trying to make their way into the United States and died in the process. They were found in an abandoned railroad car and they were dead. And one of the things that the story says is that nobody knew who they were. And that was a story that you saw, and you apparently had made a great impression with you because you, in a sense, I don't know if literally or metaphorically, you had it in your pocket and you had it with you, and that formed the basis for the first novel. And this was when you had actually, you were in Ohio, I think, at the time, so you had moved away from home. Talk a little bit about why that story grabbed you and then how that grew into Crossing.
Well, you know, San Antonio and, in fact, South Texas is a place that you have a constant influx of immigrants from Mexico. So it's a culture that is constantly sort of renewing itself and always changing and always in flux. And I think that so that, in fact, growing up, I knew a lot of people who had been undocumented, who came to this country and had been, grown up hearing stories of people making the journey, crossing over the border. And I wanted – I think when I decided to come to Ohio and I decided to go to Ohio State for a graduate degree in creative writing – I suddenly found myself in a place when I moved to Columbus, and I'd never been out of Texas before, in what really seemed to me to be a very foreign type of culture. I had grown up in South Texas, in San Antonio, never having to think about my own ethnicity, because I grew up on the West Side, and it just was the environment. So coming to Ohio, going north, put me in the position of feeling somewhat discombobulated, alienated in a place that in which I really started to confront my identity because people pointed it out to me in nice ways, but they would ask me if I was Hispanic in kind of low, secretive tones as if it was something that they were a little bit embarrassed about having to ask. But I think I found myself in the position of feeling somewhat in the same kind of space that these migrant workers who had died, and of course they suffered all kinds of deprivations that I didn't. But I did suddenly come to this realization, well, I've come up north. I've made this trip myself, and I've made it in order to hopefully build something for myself, build something for my family. And so it is a kind of sacrifice. It is a lonely place to go. And so it for the first time, I wasn't just hearing these stories. I felt as if I was experiencing some of that discombobulation. And so I got to Ohio, got to Columbus. The weather was cold. I wasn't prepared for that. There was snow everywhere. People didn't speak Spanish. People couldn't pronounce my last name. And suddenly I started to think, I think I can really get into the mindset of why somebody would make this journey. Because I asked it of myself the entire time that I was up in Columbus. Why did I come up here? Why did I leave my family? Why did I leave San Antonio? And of course, it was in the hopes of building something. But being isolated and being in a foreign place and actually having a dorm room that was very much shaped like a boxcar, I'd started to write this young man's story, and it's written in the first person. And so a lot of the kind of fear and anxiety and alienation that comes out in that novel was something that I was experiencing myself at that time.
Yeah, and there, you know, in the course of the book, where we have these men locked in the rail car, there's this sort of the central character, this young man, 17
years
old, who is young and trying to find a future in the United States, and so he pays his money, and he's in the car there, and meets an older man. who I'm guessing probably could be his grandfather of that age. And these two men establish kind of bond. I think they're in each in their way is trying to look out for the other. But it seems that one of the things that's really important to the older man is telling his story to the young man. So, and that seems like that's something really, people telling the need to tell their personal story seems something that's really important.
It is. I think, first of all, growing up in a Mexican-American culture, you know, the story and the telling of one's story is very important. And I imagine that's probably similar in many cultures. But also, having grown up in a very large family with lots of siblings, having an interesting story to tell is important if you want to be heard. Otherwise, you get drowned out by all the other good stories that people are telling. But yes, I think all of my fiction is very much concerned with finding characters and letting them tell their own stories and putting people into conversation together. It's where intimacy is created. It's where trust is created. It's where history is explored on a grassroots level. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's a mission of any writer to give voice to the people that they've met, to the things that they've seen. Conversations are important because it's where people reveal themselves. And so I think if you look at the sort of common theme in most of my fiction is this idea that people have their stories to tell and that in the telling of that story, they achieve a kind of dignity that often escapes them in the outside world.
Yeah. And it seems that another thing that comes up, at least in these two first novels, has to do with young men trying to figure out what it means to be a man. And talking about negotiating borders. Well, here's one. Here's a big one: the border between adolescence and manhood. Whatever those two things mean.
Absolutely. I teach a lot of very young writers in my capacity as an instructor in creative writing, and a lot of times they'll come to me and they'll say, "Well, you know, I'm only 18. I'm only 19. I really don't know what I have to write about yet." And so, you know, you get a lot of stories that are somewhat cliched, or they could be written for a television show. And I tell them, you know what? Don't skip that. You know, you actually do have more to write about than you have any idea at this point. I mean, growing up, adolescence, navigating these kinds of cultural constructs about what it means to be a woman, or what it means to be a man, what it means to be a son or a daughter, or a number of other kinds of things that are thrown at you growing up, negotiating those things are full of drama. It's full of tension. It's full of uncertainty. And that's the making of good fiction. So at one point I bemoaned the fact that I was telling a writer friend of mine, you know, I seem to write so much about young narrators. I think my next novel I'm going to write about somebody who's middle-aged. And he said, no, forget that. You know, stick to writing about young narrators, because the structure of the tension of fiction is right there. Most of my novels, most of my fiction deals with young men trying to figure out who they are and what their place in the world is. And in that way, I have tried to include or be as inclusive in my fiction as possible, even though most of it is about Mexican-American young people, young men. Those questions about attempting to navigate adolescence and young adulthood are universal. I mean, I don't care what the culture is. I don't care what what your race is, where you grew up, what class you grew up in. Those struggles seem to be things that people can find themselves in and project their own journeys into. And so that's what keeps me writing, is because I know that I can give voice to a particular unique place at the same time that I can speak to readers independent of their backgrounds. Yeah.
So do you have in mind, though, a particular person as your ideal reader?
Well, yes and no. I think most writers, and I'll speak for myself, see themselves as their ideal writer. You know, so if I write something and I want to read it, or I'd want to read it, then that's something that I'm going to follow through. But I guess the ideal reader for me is anyone, which is everyone, who has encountered difficulties. It's encountering difficulties and figuring out a way around them or over them or under them that keeps me writing, figuring out how do people survive. And so survival is maybe the central theme in most of my fiction. How do people deal with what life throws at them? Because we all do it to a certain extent. We all find ways of improvising when we need to and of taking what we need where we can find it. And that's what's fascinating to me, and that's what I continue to explore. And that's what young adulthood is all about.
Yeah. We're getting close here to the midpoint. Manuel Martinez is our guest. He's a writer, professor of American and Chicano literature at Ohio State University in Columbus. He's here visiting the campus to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. He's authored three novels, Crossing, Drift, and his newest is Day of the Dead. And he's going to do a reading this afternoon at 4:30 at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. Anybody who is interested can stop by. And, of course, you can go out and look for his novels if you'd like to sample them. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you have, I see here on the table in front of us, you have copies of the three books. I'm sure that people would like to hear a little something. You want to do a reading?
Sure. I will read the opening to my newest novel, Day of the Dead, that was published this year. And it is the opening act, if you will, to the book. It's called Invocation. And just to give you a brief background, this is follows the older gentleman that you were talking about in my first novel, Crossing, and I had always intended to go back and write his story in a more in-depth way. And so this is his story, and this is the beginning of it. Invocation. It is said by the old ones that without human blood, the sun would cease to give life, that sacrifice fuels Coatlicue, the embodiment of the cosmos. Coatlicue thrives on death, in the struggle of oppositions most perfectly expressed in war. Only through its waging can existence be prolonged. I, Berto Morales, in the midst of war, in the midst of terrible loss and death, have given myself to this dictate of the cosmos. One night, a year ago, I found myself standing in deep woods, a paralytic, unable to step forward. In the dark, the stars blanketed by black clouds, I listened. For what? A sound, any sound, a cricket in darkened longing, a creature scuttling for protective bush, a coyote howling for unseen comfort. To be alive, to hear life, and it came to me, slowly, deeply, the beat of my heart. My heart is full of hatred, inhabited by the black twin. I've cultivated, fed it, as a freezing man might feed a dying fire, watching for signs of dimming embers, always at the ready to stir them up, to pile on fresh, dry wood as I rub my cold hands over the warmth upon which I know life depends. The nine levels of Mictlan are to be traversed by the spirits of Los Muertos, wandering through each underworld, each deeper than the last, the fleshless made to undergo a series of trials for 4 years before rest can be earned. The black twin, the red twin, are said to have battled through these levels in order to bring redemption. My curse is that the red twin, love, has bled to death in my soul, and peace has died with it. It is said that only the warrior dying in glorious battle can move directly to the fourth heaven, and so I have dedicated myself to this, my only hope of redemption, La Calle Roja, the bloody road. And if this slim hope of salvation is but a chimera, a brutal and faithless dream, I will have lost nothing because there is nothing left in this charred heart to lose. But my heart is not dead, even though all that it hungers for no longer lives. My wife, our child unborn, never to be. My home burned, my heart so heavy with grief that until now I dared not pause to think. It is said that the sorrowful, tired unto death, filled with the courage to find relief at the end of a rope, are led to heaven by Ishtab, the moon, the goddess of the gallows. They find grace in the death of angels' lunacy. But I have no rope, and more so lack the faith for such valor. The Maya, obsessed with the cosmic end, their calendars and astronomy calculated to predict the apocalypse, trace the movement of the planet Venus. They believe the cosmos is a battlefield, an eternal cycle of violence. They do not seek meaning so much as they seek to live with its movement rather than against it. If it be strife, then to seek peace would be futile, an act of self-delusion. I remember in that dark wood how hatred had rescued me before, how as a young man I had taken in hand like a hammer or sickle and killed. Hatred scorched me in half, consuming much of the flesh of my hand while somehow salvaging my soul. I recalled how before, as a child, hatred had stoked my fury to flame and hastened my escape. In a moment I burned my captor's house and brought its roof down upon his head. I resolved to hate anew, to fill the emptiness of my cleaved heart with murder so that a fierce balance might be created, so that I might be able to move, if not forward, then backward. I am to be executed in the morning, a target pinned to my chest, my heart's life extinguished. I go willingly. To this you alone bear witness. This is no confession, it is a telling, an admission that the grit lingering in my mouth is the only taste left of this, my last year. It is all I have retained, this vestige of my journey, the ashes of my past, my life, my death, my story. I am Berto Morales. I am the false son of a nameless and blind man. I am war. I took his land through a pretense. I am pestilence. When his heir returned to claim his birthright, I killed him. I am murder. His comrades returned to find me, and failing to do so, took the life of my wife and child. I was love. I determined to meet injustice with injustice. I am hatred. I brought war to those who ended my life. I am executioner. I am guilty of sins that have no name. I have come to the slaughter uninvited and have determined to give my life freely. It is an empty gift from a man long dead.
Yeah. It's really beautiful. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
And I'm really struck by, in all of these books, the voice of these characters is very strong. So is the character that tells the story in Drift. It's a different person at a different age, at a different time, at a different place. But that also has a very, very strong, very distinctive voice. Where do those come from, do you think?
Well, you know, voices, and I think this is the case with many writers, voices is the key to finding a story. Mm-hmm. And for me, once I find a voice of a character, I know that the story is going to write itself in a sense, because this character will begin to tell his or her own story. But I spend a lot of time listening, and in a culture such as mine, where you grow up listening to people's stories, you start to listen to the inflections and the ways that people talk and the rhythms that they use. You internalize those. So for the voice in Drift, I tried to capture the way that I thought and talked at that time. I spent a lot of time with my much younger brother, Eli, who's 12 years younger than me, and his friends, and tried to listen to what they were talking about and what their concerns were. For this voice, for Berto Morales, I really did channel my sort of more middle-aged voice and tried to think about the idea of loss. Even though I didn't grow up in 1912 and in Mexico during revolution, but I have, in fact, encountered a great deal of loss in my life. And that's what Berto Morales is trying to figure out in Day of the Dead. He's trying to figure out, how have I gotten here, and how have those things that meant so much to me been taken from me, and who do I go see about this? How do I rectify this? Is there any way of maybe perhaps finding kind of a redemption for those sins that I brought upon myself? So for me, it's about listening, and it's about capturing a sensibility, because that's going to lead me into the story.
Yeah, this is not an original observation on my part, but it seems that you're interested in following characters who are on almost mythic journeys, talking about dealing with big forces on almost a cosmic scale, or at least maybe that's you can feel like that is in your life. And I don't know if I'm thinking about this later. Later on, I'm going to be talking with Zachary Mason about his new book, Lost Books of the Odyssey, which is all about probably one of the best known characters in all of Western fiction. Odysseus, a guy whose story has been told over and over and over again. So obviously, these stories about people taking the journeys like that are something that really appeal to us, and that maybe we see our own daily struggles in their lives as we see them battle monsters or whatever, try to figure out where home is and how to get there. That's something that interests you?
Absolutely. Everyone is the main character of their own narrative. And one of the things that always used to interest me was, and still does, is say, going to a film or reading a novel in which you have a minor character sort of be part of the story for a short while, and they get sort of left in the dust. And I always thought to myself, well, these minor characters are the major characters of their own stories. And so I think all of us, to a certain extent, do that. I think we all see our own life journeys as a mythic journey. And so I think if I can tap into that, tap into the fact that every person, whether or not they have star quality in a sort of mainstream sense, that they actually do have a story to tell, and that in fact it will touch upon somebody else's notion of their own existential journey of the because we're all in search for meaning, you know. And so you don't have to go out to fight the Greeks or fight, you know, to go out on this sort of mythical journey in order to be interesting. I mean, because we're all already on our own journeys. And mortality is always at the end of it, right? There's always this huge looming abyss, and we're moving towards it. And as we do that, we're trying to figure out, how is it that I've gotten here? How is it that I've lost the things that I love most? How can I recoup them? How can I make sense of where I'm at? And that is, in fact, the center of the Odyssey. It's the center of everyone's story. And so that's the great thing about being a writer. You can create these characters. You can bring into the fold people that you've met and whose stories or parts of the stories have captured your imagination, because that's what links us all. That's what makes literature so engaging, is because we can somehow project our own journey into the midst of somebody else's and see that there's a commonality that links us all.
Yeah. Sooner or later, I'm sure all writers have to confront people who have read the books, have read their work, and maybe know a little bit about them, and look at the characters in the books and say, they say, this is you, right? This is about you, right? But certainly, I imagine, and particularly in Drift, you can see, you know, little bits, little reflections of you and your life. And I think that I actually did read at some point that you started out maybe with the idea of writing a memoir, writing something that would be nonfiction, that eventually turns into Drift. So how much would you say of your own story ends up being particularly part of that book?
Well, quite a bit of it. You know, I did initially think of it as a memoir, and I finished writing it. And I looked back on it and read it, and I thought, my God, this is depressing. Who's going to want to read this? I don't even want to read this. This is so dark. And so I decided to sort of reinvent much of the story. But I think I still think of it as an autobiography in many ways, at least in the sense that the loss that Robert engages and attempts to make sense of in that story. It was very much my struggle as a young person, seeing my family fall apart, seeing my mother fall prey to depression and to all sorts of terrible things that young people shouldn't be exposed to at that age. And so I knew I had to write that story. And really, that was probably the most gratifying book I've ever written, because I get so many readers writing to me over the last few years telling me, you know, Robert's story is my story. And it seems to cross race. It crosses gender. It crosses region. I get emails and letters from readers from places like Kansas, young white females who are writing me and saying, wow, I saw something in this kid's story that reminds me of what I'm going through, of the alienation that I feel, of the desperation that I feel. And so it's been gratifying to know that even though I'm writing about this young, poor Mexican kid growing up on the west side of San Antonio, that there are people and young people, especially all over the U.S. and other places where I've been published, that relate to it and see that their struggle has been engaged in a certain way, and that they can see some hope.
That's what I guess maybe in part what I was thinking about when I asked the question about, well, who do you think that you're writing for? Because this book in particular seems to have gotten a real big response from people, and both young men and young women, who are at that age, who can relate to that. Now, I suppose, you know, anybody should be able to relate to that. You might just be going back a little a ways. But I think I also read something where you said something that I really liked about how, well, you know, really, in a lot of ways, inside us all, there's still an adolescent there's some part of us that never quite grows out of that. And that no matter how old we are, we still occasionally can come from that place and react to things in the way that we would have when we were 17 years old. So I'm you know, interested in that. Wasn't primarily intended to be a what they call now, you know, a young adult kind of a book, but clearly people who are at that place read that story and they say, yeah, that I, yeah, I know what that's all about.
Well, you know, I, that, and that's why I wrote Drift. There, I don't, you know, when the lights go out, and I'm a night owl, and so I stay up writing most nights until 4 or 5 in the morning. That's the time that I work. And that's the time that I work because that's when the lights go out and people go to sleep and you're left alone with yourself. And, you know, I'm 43 now, but there are parts of who I am that are still that lost 17-year-old, still trying to figure out the big questions. What does it mean to be a man? What do I really love dearly? What is expendable? What is necessary? And as I said earlier, young people deal with this. And so I did write it, in essence, for younger people who are going through that journey. Reading saved my life. And I grew up in a very tumultuous situation where my parents were in and out of my life and where I was constantly getting kicked out of school for fighting or drug use or a number of problems that I got into when I was younger. And the only thing I think that kept me sane was reading books like Catch in the Rye, Catch 22, Slaughterhouse-5, books about people who are confronted with really terrible situations that are absurd on so many levels, but attempting to figure them out. And some of them related directly to my life, as in something like Catch in the Rye, and some didn't, like Catch 22. But what did relate was this sense that, yes, the world is chaotic. The people in your life come and go, but you can still make sense of it somehow.
Well, would you want to maybe read a little bit of something from Drift, just so that maybe people can hear what Robert sounds like?
Sure. I'll just read a very short little section just to give a sense of what's going on here. And here Robert is showing up for his first day of work and at a molino, which is a Mexican barbecue place where all the meat is made from cow heads. And it's his first job, and he's trying to get money together so he can run off to Los Angeles and find his mother. And it starts out, a couple of weeks later, I find out that Diana's father owns this barbacoa joint called Los Reyes Molino. And she tells me that he always needs part-time workers there, especially on the weekends. I'm not that interested. But I agree because it's kind of hard to say no when she's rubbing my belly, lying in my bed. Plus the $60 for 2 days' work doesn't sound so bad either. I show up at 5 a.m. feeling hungover. I didn't want to come. I changed my mind, but Diana called me up this morning to wake me up. I guess her dad has had too many workers who've blown it off when they feel that morning hammer come down at 4 a.m. when they try to drag themselves out of bed. The building is a squat beige deal with an ugly tin roof and a tacky white sign that says Los Reyes Molino, Barbacoa, Tamales, y Tortilla. I can't imagine any king wanting to eat that crap, but I don't have too much time to think about it or consider the irony. Once inside, Diana's mom, this fat, short woman, who seems to be moving constantly and talking at the same time, throws an apron in my direction. You Robert? She doesn't seem to know who I am. Diana's been sneaking around behind their backs. She's only 16 and not supposed to be going out, let alone hanging out with cholos like me. That's why her parents sent her to Incarnate Word High School for girls. They've made the mistake of thinking that being around the nuns and the virgin will make her good. Yeah, I'm Robert, I say, already getting a vibe that this isn't going to work out. She makes me nervous, flapping her jaws like she is, not bothering to look at me while she busies herself looking around for something to give the new boy to do. Yeah? Well, Mija told me that you're a hard worker, is that right? Uh-huh, I say, tying the white apron around my waist. Well, we'll see. She gives me a suspicious look, already sizing me up. You know, I take care of my boys so long as they work, but you gotta be busy all the time. You won't believe how busy we're gonna get today. You just wait. I don't know whether to wait or get busy, but she doesn't give me much time to think about it. Okay, you take one of those washcloths, dunk it in the water with the bleach in it, and start cleaning the counters. I take one of the cloths and start shining up the stainless steel counters, which are streaked with congealed grease. The bleach smells strong, and it covers up the whiff of corn that's barely hanging in the air. Smells good in here, I tell her, but she doesn't say anything, and I decide that that'll be the end of my chit-chat for the day. After a while, maybe about 15 minutes, this other kid comes in the door. He's thin but wiry, and he has big teeth that make him look kind of goofy, except for the fact that he doesn't look too happy about anything. Who are you? He says, none too friendly. Who are you? I say without even looking at him. I'm Reynaldo Vato, and I've been here a long time. He keeps staring at me while he ties on his apron. Yeah, that's right. Been here for 2 years. So who are you? Some damn relative? I'm a friend of Diana's. Psh, that lazy chick, he says with contempt. I hate that little chick. Watch your mouth, I say. It doesn't sound like he knows her at all. He gets this look on his face like he just discovered a Jerry Springer-type secret. Oh, you're that kind of friend. You banging her? Hey, Vato, I told you to watch your mouth. I'm getting ready to clock this fool. He turns back toward the bucket with the washcloths, and I decide to ignore him because I can see that he's a punk anyway. After a few minutes, this other guy comes in. I like him better than Ronaldo right from the beginning. He's a bodybuilder type. You can tell he's cool. He walks in humming some song or something, and he says hello to everyone with a smile. He comes up to me and offers me his hand right away. I'm Jorge. You new? Yeah, I'm Robert. He shakes my hand Chicano style, thumb grip to hooked fingers and ending with the palm to palm. But he doesn't do it corny like some of the old-timers who try, only they're too drunk and they get it all wrong. I gotta do my stuff in the back, he says. I'll talk to you later. As soon as he splits, Ronaldo comes up to me. He hates Jorge. Man, that punk thinks he's strong, he says. He ain't so strong. He thinks he's bad, always taking off on those bodybuilding contests, trying to win, coming in here bragging about how he placed. He watches him walk across the store. He don't got nothing. I got more muscles than him. I look at this. He lifts his shirt up and he shows me his stomach, which I have to admit has no fat, just a pretty defined six-pack. And this, he says, flexing his shoulders and biceps at the same time. It's getting a little gay, but I nod. You see, I just don't go showing it off. I find out that Ronaldo lives in that Alisando Courts, a housing project close to the stockyards, La Matanza. That place stinks so bad that coming in from town, you have to pass the yards where you get off the highway to get to the west side. You have to roll up the windows and hold your nose so as not to smell that sick, sweet stench. The slaughterhouse makes you want to throw up. People usually drive fast to get past the yards, but they drive even faster through Alizonda or Tripa Courts. Fools get dropped there. It's known as the most violent spot in San Antonio. Me and Grams live on the west side, but I don't go near that place. The courts are surrounded on one side by the stockyards, on the other by a huge length of drainage canals to keep the area from flooding in the rainy season. Ronaldo has to walk to work on the weekends, maybe an hour in the dark, cold morning. He tells me he doesn't care. In fact, he prides himself on it.
He's a great character. I think that the book has a lot of humor in it. I really enjoy just right off hearing him talk, and he starts out talking, I think, in the beginning about how his grandmother has decided the thing that's going to straighten him up is she puts him in a Christian fundamentalist school. It's a great, great character. So, and I can see how if you were 17 years old, you would grab onto that right away. And maybe it's the 17-year-old in me can also grab onto that too.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Manuel Luis Martinez. He's writer, professor of American and Chicano literature at Ohio State in Columbus. He was just reading from his novel, Drift. He's also authored two others, Crossing, that was his first, and his most recent is Day of the Dead. He's here visiting the campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival sponsored by the Creative Writing Program and also the Carr series. And he will be reading from his work on the campus this afternoon, 4:30, at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. And anybody, so it's free and open to the public. Anybody would like to hear more from him should stop by. And, of course, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And another thing that you really seem to be interested in is parent the relationship between parents and kids, particularly, I think, between young men and their fathers.
Yes. I think that's a common theme. You know, sons are always trying to figure out their fathers, trying to figure out how to emulate them or how not to emulate them. I grew up with a father that I dearly loved and admired very much. He's a musician, he's a guitar player. And so there was always music in the house. And even though he had to make his living as a bus driver, there was always that aspect of his life that in which he wasn't a bus driver, in which he was a musician, in which he was on stage, in which he was surrounded by people who loved art and music. And so there was music up until 2-3 o'clock in the morning in my house most times. And I grew up wanting to be my father in many ways. And then, of course, when my father left the family, that turned my life to turmoil. And so I felt very displaced, and I felt a lot of anger, a lot of confusion. And I think that has definitely permeated my work, even to the extent of writing books like Crossing or Day of the Dead, which are about immigrants, people who are displaced from their fatherland, if you will, that have been disappointed not by their biological fathers, but have been cast adrift by their nation, their culture, their place. And so I do tend to want to explore that because you learn so much from your father, and you learn so much about how to handle situations. And when that presence is missing, you have to improvise. You have to figure it out on your own. And so, you know, for a long time, I resented that breakdown in the relationship. And then after I got a little bit older, I looked back, and of course, life teaches you that things don't go perfectly and that you can't expect your parents to live up to the unrealistic idealizations that you have of them growing up. But I also figured out that I wouldn't have become a writer if it weren't for the fact, a couple of things, that my father himself was an artist, and that, in fact, my father couldn't live up to his own expectations. And that from a very early age, I figured out there are these things, these pressures, these structures that are placed upon us, and they box us in. And we spend most of our lives trying to crawl our way out of those boxes. And sometimes that means letting yourself down. Sometimes it means letting the people around you down. And so a lot of the characters in my books are coming to this sort of realization that they won't be able themselves to live up to the expectations they have of themselves. And that brought me a lot of peace and understanding in the relationship between myself and my father. But it's still something that's there and that's constant, that's a constant in anything that I write.
Yeah, I read someplace that you really, maybe one of the reasons that you started writing was that there was some distance, or maybe there were things that you wanted to be able to talk about with your father that somehow you couldn't, or you didn't, or you hadn't, and that in some way writing the story gave you a way to say something that you wanted to but otherwise couldn't.
Yeah, you know, in fact, very literally, because when I was about 20, my father was diagnosed with cancer, and so he had to have surgery, and he had to go through chemo and all these sorts of things. And I, at a certain point, I think when I found out, maybe it was a couple of nights before he was going to go in for major surgery, and I thought to myself, you know, I have never had a real conversation with my father. There's always been this gulf, either of admiration of kind of a child relationship to your parent, but I've never had anything. I've never been able to tell him the things that he meant to me and what his leaving meant to me. And so I sat down, and it was the first short story I'd ever written, and I wrote about the night that I first realized my father wasn't coming back when I was about 12 years old. And it was kind of a hammy story, melodramatic in its own ways, but I wrote it and I gave it to him to read before his operation, and he read it. And after he came out of surgery, a day or two later, he said to me, you know, I really want to talk to you about this stuff, and I want to let you know what happened and why I did what I did and how confusing it was for me and how I know it. You know, and it opened up the door. And that was a realization to me. I thought, you know what? This fiction stuff is really powerful. You know, because things that you can't say to a person face to face, you can put it out there. You can put these ideas out there, and you can dramatize them in ways that you can't do in a conversation. And so it was the beginning of my writing career, to see that I could reach someone as distant as my father.
Yeah. Something else that you write about in fiction, and I think in some more, I guess you would say, scholarly writing that you have done, and I know you're interested in it, and it goes back to, you know, some of the things that we've talked about, characters that you would like to write about who are on journeys that are both literal and more metaphorical. This thing that you're interested in, mobility, and how we, in this country, talk about the freedom to move around as if that's one of our important rights. And certainly there are a lot of writers who have written about that. For somebody like some of the characters you write about, though, this whole business of movement is a whole different sort of a thing. It's maybe not so much a matter of choice. And it's not like being on a long vacation. What about this whole subject of mobility interest you?
Well, you know, first of all, I think being on the move is where action happens, right? It's where things happen. It's where you encounter the unknown. So that was very interesting to me. But I think particularly in American culture, from the very founding of this nation, you know, the idea of exploration, the idea of finding the self in what's out there is central to so much of the fiction. And I remember reading On the Road for the first time, and reading it just after I read a book by Ernesto Galarza called Barrio Boy, both books about immigrating or migrating, say moving around the country, and both seem so foreign to each other and yet so similar in many ways, because they capture the desire to move and the hope that movement allows. But in the case of migrant workers or immigrants, the idea that mobility is ultimately liberating is quickly done away with, because it very quickly becomes a kind of rut, a kind of pattern in which you're constantly in motion but never getting anywhere. And I remember one of the lines, one of my favorite lines from literature is Tomás Rivera's, comes from Tomás Rivera's novel, And the Earth Did Not Devour Him. And one of the women who's a migrant says, you know, we keep moving, but we never arrive. The truth is we're always moving, but we never arrive. And I thought to myself, boy, that captures not only the life of a migrant, but the life of most Americans, in that we're constantly pressed to keep moving, to keep searching, to keep striving. And yet sometimes we look back on our lives and we think, but my God, I've just been turning in circles. And that fascinates me as well, that kind of struggle, that kind of tension in that.
Why do you think it is that, given that this idea and also the idea of leaving one place and going to another place in search of a better life, because that new place represents so much, I mean, maybe too much, you know, given that that's so much a part of our story, why is it that we won't let people do that? I mean, why is it that we want to build walls to prevent people from doing that?
You know, that's a great question. I keep coming up across that when I think about current events. You know, I think about the kind of xenophobia that has fired up so much political discourse around immigration and other sorts of issues here in the U.S. And I think that's really interesting, because, you know, as Americans, I think part of our narrative is that we admire the striving, we admire the mobility, the movement, this search, and yet, when we're threatened or we feel that our prerogatives are threatened, we seem to want to shut people out. We want to build the walls. We want to patrol the border. And it's a paradox. And I don't really know how to answer that. My solution to it, or at least my intervention in that, is to try and depict these people that are seen as foreigners in ways that will relate to the American dream, to the American mm-hmm. the American journey. Because it's there.
And that's, again, it's something that I really, I find sort of perplexes me, that somehow people think that the American dream and these sort of cherished American values are somehow being assaulted or challenged or in danger of being lost, when it seems to me that so many of the people want to come here, that's why they want to come here. It seems to me like they bought into all that stuff to a degree that cynical Americans have just blown off a lot of that stuff. And yet people continue to come here because they actually believe that.
Well, you know, and that's why telling my grandmother's story, for instance, she's a main character in Drift, Maria Martinez. You know, she had a fourth, fifth grade education. She was the daughter of an undocumented worker. She was a migrant worker herself. And yet she had nothing but great things to say about this country. And she instilled in me at a very early age, read, study, work hard, because this is a country, this is a place where if you do those things, you will find your way. And I have to say that I agree with her wholeheartedly. I mean, it is my experience. It was her experience. I mean, I'm only one, two generations removed from that immigrant experience, and yet here I am. And I have it. My grandmother passed away when I was 18 years old, so she never got to see me succeed at this level. But she would be amazed to think that I'm sitting here at a radio station being interviewed in Illinois. I mean, this is a state, Michigan, Illinois, that she spent time picking tomatoes and working out in the crops, and here I am, firmly ensconced in the middle class and in the intelligentsia, and it is a miracle. It is miraculous. There is, and so immigrants embody that. And so I think it's something that if I can help Americans to understand that the strivings and the yearnings of this group of people are very similar to them, then I'm doing my job as a writer, at least what I see as my mission as a writer.
Here we've got to stop. We're at the end. Our guest, Manuel Luis Martinez, will be giving a reading from his work this afternoon at 4:30 in the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus in the Author's Corner. He's here visiting as part of the Early Spring Literary Festival sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. He is professor of American and Chicano Literature at Ohio State University in Columbus. His novels are Crossing, Drift, and the most recent is Day of the Dead. Thank you.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.
Programs here on WILL made possible in part by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts presenting What It Is, featuring Mavis Staples, Booker T., and J.J. Gray on March 30th. More information on this and other events can be found at KrannertCenter.com. We're WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. It is 1 minute before noon. You're tuned to WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at $4.94 3/4, up 6.5. July, $5.05 1/4, up 6 3/4. Chicago May wheat, $4.85 1/2, up 6 1/4. July, $4.98 1/4, up 6 1/4. May corn, $3.66 1/4, up 3. July, $3.77, up 2 3/4. September, $3.85 1/2, up 1 3/4. December, $3.96, up 3. May beans, $9.44 3/4, up 14 3/4. July, $9.52, up 14 1/2. August, $9.49 3/4, up 14 1/4. September, $9.35 1/2, up 14. November, $9.25, make that $9.26, up 12. May meal, $2.619.